and talking with me today.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here.
So I want to start at the beginning and just kind of work our way through. Out of curiosity, what got you into Eastern thought and Eastern ideas and practices in the first place, way back?
When I was in high school, a friend of mine gave me a book called The Gospel of Ramakrishna. And that's the what that is a diary of about that this devotee wrote about his guru that after spending many years with his guru, he had perfect retention memory, so he used to write out everything that happened, and it was published that he died. And I guess I was always looking for a deeper connection to things. And I was always dealing with an inability to really get out of my head and into whatever I was doing. My, you know, combination of stupidity and neurosis, I guess, you know. When I read this book, it blew my mind because what they were describing was these incredible interactions with a really great saint, a really great yogi. It was amazing to me, you know, it just like, and then from that point on, then I got Autobiography of a Yogi and Zen and Japanese culture, and then I was gone.
Yeah, what's interesting about that to me, and I've had an experience that seems like it might have been similar to yours, in that you were always interested in music, and I have been too, and I've just recently, like, as I've stumbled into Eastern thought, for me it seemed like I've just recently realized that both of them were actually getting at the same thing, and I used to assume that I was confusing like the method with what it was actually getting to. And it seems like with music, like you're talking about this feeling of kind of like getting out of your head and like getting into what you're doing. And music has been like that for me. And then you start learning about these things and you realize that it actually does the same thing, but through words. Is that a similar experience what you've had?
But you see, there is a difference, and it's a really big difference, actually. Music is very powerful, and it can get you out of your thoughts, and it can jumpstart deep emotional states and feelings. But what it doesn't do, it doesn't plant any seeds of freeing yourself permanently from the things, from all that stuff that causes us suffering.
It's like it's more of a temporary fix.
It's a temporary release. You know, it's a pleasure, actually, is what it turns out to be.
Gotcha.
And we like pleasure. We don't like pain. So we crave pleasure and we try to avoid pain. The problem is it's the craving mechanism, which is exactly the same as the pushing away mechanism. It's one thing. We want to hold on to pleasure and we want to avoid pain. It's impossible to hold on to pleasure for any, you know, for more than like, you know, I mean, if you're really good, you know, maybe, yeah. But you can hold on for a while, but eventually it ends. And when it ends, there is some kind of suffering. It doesn't satisfy the hunger permanently, right? That's the point. So that's what I always say. So in Eastern thought, Eastern philosophy, and so-called Eastern spiritual philosophy, the essence of everything we're looking for is already within us. And it's underneath the emotions, deeper than the thoughts and the feelings that come and go. it's a living, breathing presence or state of mind, state of consciousness within us. And the pleasure that we get from music and other experiences mirrors that, but it doesn't really tap that place, because those feelings inside they don't begin and they don't end. There's no beginning. There was never a time when you were not here, nor will there ever be a time when you won't be here. But we don't know that here.
Mm-hmm.
That can only be known through what you could call intuition or a deeper kind of awareness or that kind of thing. So yeah, you know, so they have in India and in the so-called East all kinds of methods to free us from the things that cause us pain. And one of those methods is mantra practice, you know, mantra meditation, the repetition of what in India they call the names of God, which simply means the names of your own true nature. And so like when I chant with people, I always say the music, you know, if a kid is sick and you want him to take medicine, you have to hide that medicine in a sweet syrup, right? Or the kid's not going to take the medicine. So the music is the syrup, but the name or the mantra is the medicine. They come together mostly, especially at the beginning, meaning the first 300 million lifetimes, because we don't want to take the medicine. You know, we're too busy. So we look for pleasure, but in the pleasure of music, we're also sneaking in the medicine,
yeah,
so to speak, and planting those seeds. And those seeds are the seeds of what doesn't come and what doesn't go. It's who we are. Yeah. And, you know, if music was enough, every musician would be, like, happy, you know?
Right.
I don't think so.
Right. So it's the philosophy, the spirituality, those ideas, those seeds that you're talking about, it's like it's digging into a deeper, more fundamental level. And then, like, the music and the more pleasurable activities are kind of, like, a level or two above that's building on top of it. But if the seed's not really there, then you're not going to get to the root issue.
Yeah. Yeah. The music and beauty and art, all those things are there in the world of the senses. You experience them through your senses. They can inspire deeper feelings, but it kind of depends on who made the art, who's making the music, what's their inspiration, where are they coming from, you know?
Mean.
So it's just, we're pleasure seekers and we're pain avoiders. That's the way we've been brought up. That's the way the cultures are in this world, pretty much. Everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. But we have bad aim. That's the deal. You know, we try to grab the wrong things in the wrong way. And so we're doomed to failure in terms of if we're looking for happiness, so to speak, outside of us, it's just not there.
Yeah.
It's temporarily okay, but you know, and then your girlfriend leaves you and you have a fucking nervous breakdown. What are you going to do? It's inevitable, you know, or she doesn't leave you and you have a nervous breakdown.
It's even more confusing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no lack of confusion out there for sure.
Yeah. So how did your relationship with music change back at this point when you had first started reading these books?
Well, still at that point, I was pretty young and I was really... I was really into the blues, you know, because it gave me I could relate to it, you know, I felt it. It was very deep for me and it really saved me all through my teens, you know, and and early on, because it was my only way out. And it was just it's a gentle ripening process over years. You think you know something. I mean, even if you don't really think you know something, you act as if you, but then something opens up and you go, oh, you know, and then you're a little deeper in there and then, oh, you know, so it's a process.
Feeling.
That process has to be cultivated. It doesn't happen by accident. One has to cultivate and consciously seek something that's lasting and rich and giving. However, that doesn't mean that, I mean, the seeds that we planted in previous lifetimes can come to fruition right now. It's not like, and we go, oh, you know, and that's, you see that a lot, you know, like somebody will be very involved in things and all of a sudden, wait a minute, you know, this is not working. And how did they even recognize that? Because in the world, people get born, they graduate high school, they drink some beer and they die. And they're not here for a moment, you know? So how does it happen that somebody gets born, graduates high school, drinks some beer and goes, wait a minute, you know, what am I doing?
Yeah.
It's all lawful. It's all, but it's not so easy to see why and how those things happen.
How do you interpret the Lama Sirya Das idea that enlightenment's an accident?
Lama Sirya Das and I are very old friends, and he's real. The amount of practice that guy has done is unbelievable. He's really a special guy. What he means by that, I might imagine, is that enlightenment, you can't push a button and get enlightened.
Yeah.
Even if you sit down and I'm going to meditate myself to enlightenment, it's not going to happen. So when it does happen, it's accidental in the sense of that you didn't do it.
Right.
Because you will never get enlightened. Enlightenment is when you are not there anymore.
Right.
When you become transparent. When who you think you are has become transparent. But we think we're the doer. We think, you know, you think you're doing this, I think I'm doing this, you know? So we're fucked right from day one. There's nothing we can do about that. But through practice, our experience actually changes. It will change. We will experience this differently. And who you think you are and who I think I am, it seems that they're meeting and it seems like we're seeing the same thing in each other, but who knows, right? Yeah. Who knows what I'm seeing, what you're seeing. So in a sense, it's accidental. It's that you can't cause it. You right. can't cause enlightenment. Enlightenment is already, but we're not aware of it. So in order to recognize that awareness, practice is necessary. But don't think that you're going to make it happen by doing practice. It's going to happen when you finally see through seeing through who you think you are. But,
well, yeah. Go ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah. So we plant these seeds and then we don't stand over them to see if they're growing, you know. We plant the seeds and we go on with our lives. But the seeds do grow and they grow. And they come to fruition. And as they do, the way we see the world, the way we see ourselves, the way we see our lives actually is transformed little by little.
Yeah,
and if you see something differently, you act differently.
Mm-hmm. There's such a funny subtlety and kind of paradox to these things. So you're talking about so long as you think that there's some kind of you that's like attaining enlightenment or like trying to get the thing, then it's just not going to happen. But it only happens once you slip out of it in a way that like it's hard to even comprehend or realize, because it means that like you have to kind of, in a way, at least temporarily disintegrate the thing that you've been identifying with the whole time. So it's hard to even try to describe what you're talking. Like, I think I get it, but not really, because it's so weird to try and think about it. It's almost as if like the second that you try to think about it, it disappears.
Yeah, like Ramana Maharshi was one of the greatest saints that ever lived. He used to say, asking the mind or the ego to kill the mind or ego is like asking the thief to be the policeman. There'll be a lot of investigation, but no arrest will ever be made. It's like that. So that's kind of the way it is. So one has to just kind of try to get through the day and keep breathing. And that leaves room for a lot of things to happen.
I'm curious about when you first heard about from your friends Ram Dass coming back to the United States, and they were talking about they were going to go over there and you didn't want to go. What was going through your head when you first heard about him?
I wasn't interested in any white yogis. I wanted the real thing. Who gives a shit about this asshole, you know? So, but when they came back and the guy stepped out of the car and turned around and looked at me, there was light shooting out of his head. I went like, holy shit, give me the directions, I'm leaving, you know? So, and of course it turned out later that they had gone up to see him, and then they had dropped acid and been played around for 2 days, and they were still kind of coming down by the time they got back home. So, but it was okay. It got me there.
Dude, tell me about that first experience when you first met him, you first walked into that house. What was that like?
I was very, maybe still am, kind of a cranky guy, you know? And, so I drove up there. I drove all night through the huge storm, and my car's heater didn't work. I had about 40 cups of hot coffee chocolate. It was so cold. And I got there, and there was snow everywhere. I parked the car, turned the engine off, and there was a hole in my muffler. So all night long, it's been like, you know, so all of a sudden, boom, silence. It was so quiet. And I felt this thing in my chest go, whoop. And I thought, what the fuck is that? Am I having a heart attack? What's going on here? All right, that's weird. So then I walked up and I knocked on the door, and this guy opens up the door, you know, he has a beard, and he just points up the stairs, right? And I thought, oh, these people, I gotta get out of here. These people are fucking crazy, you know? But it was too late. That turns out to be Rameshwar Das. He opened the door for me. And he's the one who wrote Ram Dass's book, Being Ram Dass, you know? He's one of my best friends, of course, longtime best friends. So I walked up the steps and kind of into this loft room. And on the other side of the room, Ram Dass was sitting. There was a mattress on the floor, and he was sitting, kind of meditating, or leaning up against the wall, and his eyes were closed. The minute I walked into that room, my life changed. The minute I walked into that room without a word being spoken, without eye contact, something happened in me. And I knew that whatever it was I was looking for, it was real. It existed. It was in the world, and you could find it. And just like that, a blink of an eye. And that was the beginning of the rest of my life. And that was like my first non-drug-induced experience of the presence of my guru.
Right.
That was Maharaji. And that presence has never changed. That's been with me from that moment, even before that moment, of course, but that was my first awareness of it that I remember. But I've spent most of my life not remembering to look, not allowing myself to feel that, which is interesting. My karmic package has so much habitual heaviness that I don't allow myself to partake of the meal that's on the table. You know, it's very interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of talking about it, saying that it was, you know, because we hear a lot about this idea that it's always there, and you're saying, you know, that it had always been there, but you hadn't allowed yourself to look for it until you're in the presence of him. Was it that, and the same thing with Maharaji, was it that you're around somebody that was finally like allowing themselves to be in that place without like taking themselves out of it? Was it just like you've finally been around somebody? Because it's a very abnormal state, at least in my experience, like living in the United States. Like I've been around very few people, if anybody, who's been like what you're describing, that's really allowing them to like sink into this place, because we're all kind of like wrapped up and like chasing these different things. So it's just like somebody giving you, just in the way that they were living, somebody giving you permission to like sink.
No, that's too complicated.
Okay.
It was just, he was in it. I felt it. Now, he wasn't always in it.
Right.
And he wasn't always aware of it himself. He went through his own stuff. He had his issues. Ramdas did over his life, for sure. Mm-hmm. But Maharaji, see, this is the part that could get a little bit difficult. Maharaji was using him, was transmitting through Ramdas. He had merged with Ramdas, entered into him, opened him up, and he was flowing through him. Just like when we sing together, he flows through the voice. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who meditate. There are many people who do practice. And that's all good. It's all useful, it's good, and you have to. This is a little bit different in the sense that this is what they call transmission. This is, you know, this is the grace and the blessings of a real guru, not a wannabe, you know. This is the real thing. So, and you can feel Maharaji in it. He's always transmitting. All we have to do is think of him and his trance, and we can feel something. And he said, see, now we're in a whole different ballgame here. He said, once I take your hand, I never let go. Even when, not if, even when you let go of mine. And he also said, when you think of me, I'm there. Well, who could say something like that, right? This must be somebody who is merged with the soul of the universe, who is, has become, because your soul, my soul, whatever a soul is up to, that's a whole philosophical discussion that never ends. But let's think of it as there's a moon, right? And the moon is reflected in many different ponds and pools and lakes. Each one is different and the same. It's the same light, right? So a great guru and a realized being knows themselves to be that light. They're not. They're not identified with the differences. They know themselves to be that one light that's reflected in the pool or the lake of each person's heart. Mm-hmm. So this is who a great saint really is. And those great beings can do whatever they need to do for us, because that's the only reason they're here, by the way. It's because we don't know shit. We're suffering. So they have to be here because they have compassion for us. They have real compassion, and they care, and they want to help us get through our nonsense and get over our suffering. Why? Because they're not different than us. And if we're suffering, they're suffering. And so it's natural. Real compassion is natural. You don't have to fake it.
Yeah.
When you see, yeah, for these great beings, compassion is the world they live in.
Yeah, what you said about compassion is something that I think about sometimes. It's like there's not that it's necessarily, you know, bad. Like there's worse things to do, but there's something weird about contrived, you know, quote unquote kindness or compassion. And it sounds like you're talking about if you're in a certain state, then the real thing actually just kind of emerges of itself naturally. You don't have to like push it out.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about is like the Salvation Army kind of compassion, you know, out to save the world kind of compassion, which is really self-centered. And it's not really about other people. It's about making myself feel good. I'm the savior. I'm going to help everybody. I'm going to do this. On the other hand, if somebody's hungry, you feed them.
Right.
How hard is that to understand, you know? But do people do that? No. Rich people with money, they want to protect their money. They don't give. It's very interesting. You know what they say? They say if a person has money, a person has stuff, it's because they've been generous in a previous life. And so here now, there are people with stuff who aren't being generous. So what are they doing? They're burning the karmas that they themselves created that got them the stuff, and they're not creating more karmas for more stuff in another life. It's interesting, huh? And that's because of a lack of understanding the way things work.
What's the way that you think about karma? Because I hear it interpreted in a few different ways, and I'm not, you know, this is any time that, you know, I venture into these kinds of ideas, it's always interesting because it's always like, I think I know what it means. And then I hear like different interpretations and I realize that there's usually more to all of these things than I thought.
The first thing about karma is that what they say, only a fully enlightened being can understand it. They say it's too vast. They say we've all been everything to every other being in the universe. Mother, father, enemy, brother, sister, lover, murderer, everything. We've all been everything to everybody over endless, infinite lifetimes. So understanding the ways karma works. And they say there's two kinds of karma. There's the big package, all your karmas. And then there's the package, the little package of what you're going to get to work through this life. You know, so what is a karma? A karma is a seed, you could say. Every action, every thought, everything you do, is you plant a seed. For instance, if you want to be happy, well, no, let's not go there. It's like an ocean, waves on the ocean, okay? You're standing at the beach and waves are coming at you from some big storm way out that may have happened last week out on the ocean, but the waves are still coming, right? But how you meet that wave, if you push against the wave, you, that energy, you created that kind of energy. If you allow the wave to break over you, and not, and even if it knocks you down, fine, you fall, but you get back up. If you don't fight against it, you, that's a different type of action you took, right? And that created a different type of seed, planted a different type of seed. If you keep fighting the waves, eventually, you know, but if you allow them to come over you and allow, so what this in daily life, many things happen to us all day long, all life long. How we meet each moment is what's ultimately important. Because we identify with our egos, because we think we are who we think we have to protect ourselves. We need this much food. We need this much money. We need to lock the door so nobody steals it. We have to, you know, we live inside of this prison of me. And we do everything we can to keep it pleasant, full of pleasure and no pain, and protect it from the outside world. That's a whole karmic predicament that sets us up for a lot of intense stuff, right? We walk through life, we're protecting ourselves, worrying about other people, how we this. So cause and effect. If you tap into the caring about people and treating yourself well and treating others well, you create an atmosphere around you out of which other actions happen. If you live in fear and anger and anguish and violence, you create, you're living in a different type of cloud. And out of that, other actions will arise, different reactions to the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So it's just because karma doesn't start now. Now is the result of all the previous karmas. So how we're living in this moment already is mostly conditioned already. We do get a vote. But, you know, like people say, yeah, I can smoke if I want to. Yeah.
And then
knowing that it causes you cancer, sure you can. But why would you, if you were clear-minded, why would you cause yourself suffering? So a person who makes that kind of decision, you see, is not seeing things clearly. And out of that delusion, a lot of choices are made that causes suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Maharaja used to say, it's better to love everyone than try to figure it out. You know? And really, this is complicated stuff. I want to recommend a great book for you. It's called my friend Robert Svoboda, Svoboda. He's a Vedic astrologer and an Ayurvedic doctor and an incredible practitioner, spiritual practitioner. He wrote a series of books called Aghora. A-G-H-O-R-A. They're very far out. But the third book of the series is called The Laws of Karma, and it's fantastic.
Cool.
Read that book. It's really, really amazing.
I'll check that out.
His guru was, his teacher used to have own racehorses, and he used to race the horses because he knew that those beings owed him money. And by winning the horse race, they would get a chance to pay him back and free up the karma between them. Not that it would make him money. That wasn't the important thing. The important thing was freeing, breaking the knot, the karmic knot that held them together, freeing them. It freed them and it freed him. It's really, really cool stuff.
Cool. On that topic of, you mentioned smoking. What are your thoughts on forms of like prohibition or prescriptions or guidelines of like, what not to do, like whether it be like drinking, smoking, like what are your, is it that if you're Like you said that you won't do it if you're in the right state, if you're in a clear enough awareness. Does it really just come down to that, to being in the right, and you just naturally won't do those things? Or like, what are your thoughts on navigating stuff like that?
I was never a really big hash smoker. I smoke once in a while. But one day Maharaji said, he said, he looked at me and he said, "Don't smoke hash anymore." I said, "Okay." And then I went, "Jesus." I said, "Maharaji, what if like I'm back in America and I go to a party and somebody offers me some hash to smoke?" And he looked at me and said, "If you can't do a little thing like that, how will you ever find God?" And he laughed. I mean, it was an intense moment. And he said, he said LSD, which he called the yogi medicine brings you into the room with Christ, but you can't stay.
Yeah.
But it's good for beginners. So, you have to recognize that one could examine one's motivation. Are you self-medicating because you can't deal with your anxiety? And okay, so where does the anxiety come from? Wouldn't it be better to try to relieve yourself of the cause
Yeah.
than keep trying to cover it up, which is not going to work anyway, really very well? So it's just up to an individual. Mostly people self-medicate because they can't deal with shit. It hurts.
Right.
And we're all heartbroken. We've all been betrayed. And to get through the day is with carrying that weight of suffering is really unhappy. It's not easy. But are your own actions creating more suffering, or are they actually trying, or are they helping? Only you know.
Yeah.
Nobody else can tell you what to do. Anybody who tells you what to do, they better know what they're talking about. And most of them don't. Because the ones who really know don't tell you what to do.
Yeah. But you have examples of Maharaji doing that with you. What was his teaching style like with you in that sense?
Teaching style, he didn't teach. We just hung around.
Okay.
We hung around. He led us into the room where love lives. Our own minds took us out. And then he let us, the door was always open, but we took ourselves out. So then he hit you with a banana from 30 feet away when you weren't looking. And you turn around and he goes, and you're back in the room. That's how he taught us. That's how he kept bringing us back into the room where love lives, where our minds couldn't hurt us. Then our natural stupidity would kick in and we were gone again. Then he would bring us back. And he knew, he knew what everybody. There's a really cool book called, it's the first book, Parvati Marcus put a book together
Is it Love
called,
Everyone?
Love Everyone, yeah.
Yeah.
And she's reconstructed like the days, how the days were. And if there were 20 people there, you have 20 completely different versions of what happened that day.
The brave.
20 different versions of what was said, 20 different versions of what was done, 20 different versions of what we, I mean, and he, because he lives, a great guru, a real master, is what they call Antaryami, live the indwelling presence. So he lives inside of you as you, not as him, as you, as who you are. And so he knows everything you think, everything you want, blah, blah. So he can talk to you from inside you, even though it's coming from that body,
Right.
And so 20 different people had 20 different experiences of the day, because for each one, at the same time, he was talking from the inside of each person there. And this went on 24/7, 365. There was no break. He was completely, totally, absolutely beyond, and still is, actually.
So
He
it's
didn't
it
go anywhere. We did.
so it's he's you're being around like somebody in a certain state, embodying a certain thing, and then once you're there, like you can be that as well. And he's paying attention to see like when you kind of when you get like lost in thought or kind of taken out, and he's just guiding you back to that place in the way that works best for you.
You could say that, yes. That's your version
Okay,
of
yeah.
what it looks like. From his point of view, I can't imagine what it looks like because there's no one in there doing anything. It just happens.
Yeah.
He's not thinking like, oh, that guy's thinking that, let me do this. No, it just happens automatic
Yeah.
because it's all this, it's the state of grace manifesting constantly in every form. So, yeah. It was a great blessing. And, people ask me all the time, oh, I need a guru. I want a guru. I say, you don't know what you're talking about. Really, come on. Guru lives inside of us. It's not out. It's not something outside. But the romantic version of it all, oh, I want to find a guru. You don't find a guru, first of all. A guru drags your miserable ass to them
Yeah.
when you need to be there. If you don't need to be there, you just keep dragging your own miserable ass around. At least you think that. But it's not like that. Guru lives inside as your own true nature, which is always with you. But people are very habituated to not paying attention, not being mindful, not being aware, just being lost in going through their day completely asleep, which is how we spend most of our lives, asleep. But when you wake up, you see it's always been there. This dream that we live in, it's very frustrating, really. You can get over that. But not if you're thinking you're going to go find a guru somewhere. That's a waste of time.
It's missing a
Deal with
point.
the shit you have to deal with. You don't have to look very far to find your own nonsense, believe me.
Yeah, I like what I've heard Ram Dass talk about, where it sounds like he's kind of describing this way of living is like you can notice he calls it like the guru coming in drag, as far as I understand. Like whenever there's that thing that like gets you wrapped up, then you realize like, oh, that's what it is. Like it's not this thing that has to be captured inside of a given form. And again, like this is kind of me like thinking out loud as I'm trying to like piece together these ideas that are fairly alien to me, which is why it's fun like exploring into this world. But it sounds like that's what he's talking about. It's like it's just whatever the thing is that like reminds you to come back. That's kind of what the guru is. Like Parvati, I think she said that it means like remover of darkness. So like wherever that's found.
What was that, the last thing you said to them?
I think it was Parvati Marcus. I think she told me that the technical definition of guru is remover of darkness. So it's like
That's one of the,
wherever
yeah,
you find that
guru.
thing.
It's one of the definitions, the one who removes the darkness, yeah. And the darkness is just simply the absence of light, The light immediately removes the darkness. It's not, doesn't have to do anything. It's nature. Because the darkness is simply the absence of light. So once there's light, there is no darkness. It's not a, and the light is always there, but we're not looking, We're not recognizing it because we're too busy. We're programmed by our cultures to not be able to pay attention to what's going on within us. So it's a very gradual shift in the way you move through your life and through your day. If we want sweet fruit, we have to plant seeds for the sweet fruit. We can't be planting weeds and expect fruit to come from it, which is pretty much what we do. But it's very hard to, I remember when I first heard about, read about what they call bodhicitta in Buddhist circles, bodhicitta, which is the mind of compassion, and caring. I said, what the f- cares about that? I just want to be, I want to feel good. I want to get my samadhi, you know? Yeah, but it doesn't work like that, unfortunately. Because we're all in this together. And if one person is suffering, we're all suffering. So, and because we think about ourselves all the time, 24/7, 365, all we do is think about ourselves. How am I doing now? How am I doing now? They like me, they don't like me. Am I tall enough, short enough, fat enough, big enough, fast enough, slow enough? What am I, you know, it's always about me. To even begin to think about other people is amazing. And it's not easy. It only happens, in a sense, you could say it only happens if you've already created, if you've already planted those seeds at some time previously. I mean, most people just grow up and they're, and no blame to them. They want to marry, get a job, get a career, make a lot of money, be happy. That's, you know, it just doesn't really work like that. You know, it doesn't work like that. To even have the inkling that it doesn't work like that, where would that inkling come from? It comes from the seeds we've already planted, right? Otherwise it couldn't come. Nothing comes from nothing, actually. Nothing is not nothing, but comes from nothing. If you wake up, you've planted the seeds for that already, or it couldn't happen. If you're interested in this stuff at all, most people aren't, really, in terms of actual numbers. In the world, there are 8 million beings. How many? 800 million beings or something like that? No, more. Billions of people, right? There's a couple of billion people on the books.
It's a I very think we're small at like 8 billion people. Now.
Really? We've been busy, I guess.
Yeah, no kidding.
Since I last looked.
Yeah, it's ramped up quite a bit. So what was it for you, do you think, in Kirtan that really lit you up specifically?
Well, I love music. I was always played music and singing a lot. I loved it. And but it wasn't until I was in India and I heard chanting there one night as I was walking around the town I was in late at night. And I just went, what is that? I had never heard anything like that. Rock and fucking roll. I could not believe it. I just stopped. I just was paralyzed. And I was just standing there like, and some guy was going into the temple and he dragged me. Hey, come on, come in, you know, like this. And I just sat there and these guys were rocking. It was unbelievable. And the minute I heard that, I knew I could do this. This is for me. And that's it. Nothing's changed. That's it. I really, really blessed.
Yeah, it was really cool to come across your videos on YouTube. That's I think when I'd heard your name around. I think the first time I heard your music was actually when I was preparing for an episode with Parvati, and we were talking about Whisper in the Heart. She might have had like a section about you in there or something. And for some reason, I was like, oh yeah, I've heard of this guy. Like, I'll look up his music, check it out. And I saw a couple of the videos on YouTube, and It just seemed so interesting. It was unlike like anything that I'd heard before. Like nothing. Huh. Like no form of music that. Or, I mean, maybe I'd heard it, but I hadn't paid attention. But for some reason, it struck me in a different way, and it was really interesting. And like seeing all those people, like seeing this atmosphere that you're creating with this music. When you're playing, what's your way of thinking about it? Like, what do you think that you're doing? Are you thinking, or are you just kind of like letting it come through?
The last thing I want to do is be thinking.
Okay.
The last thing I want to do is be thinking, that's for sure.
So,
I'm just singing to him, you know, that's what I do. And chanting brings me deeper and deeper into that loving presence. And that's where I want to be. And so, but the trick, the catch 22, because I don't even know if young people know what that means anymore.
Yeah, we use that one.
Okay, good. The catch 22 is I had to sing with people, not in my room, not alone. That was the epiphany. I was in my apartment in New York and I was very depressed, very unhappy. And I walked from one room to the other, and I was struck with the understanding, if I did not sing with people, I would never be able to clean out the dark shadows in my own heart. And it was obvious that that's where the suffering was coming from. It wasn't anything outside of me. So if I was going to live, I was going to have to sing with people, not alone. So it took me a while to get with the program.
Well, I'm
glad
you
do it. Choice. Thank you. Yeah. Well, me too. Tell the truth. I'm glad.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah. So I'll have your site and your channels and all of that linked in the description for those who want to check it out. Outside of in the book, outside of that stuff, is there anything that you'd like to let people know about?
Thank you. I also wrote a couple of books that you might be interested in, especially the one Chance of a Lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I read that
that's,
one.
That's, yeah. I also made the audio book, which I rewrote half of the book, so it's probably better.
Oh, I did on Audible, so that works.
Don't tell them that. Then.
Okay.
You're not supposed to do that, but I just thought, who wrote this shit? I can't even understand what this is. So I just redid it.
All right, cool. That sounds good. So thanks so much for coming on today and talking with me. I really
my
appreciate
pleasure.
Your time.
Nice to meet you. And yeah.
You too. Yeah, it's
Columbus,
been fun.
Ohio. Awesome. I don't know. You know, I sang in after Cleveland, we went to 1 year. I think I might have sung in Columbus once at the Masonic Hall. Is there a big Masonic Hall there somewhere?
I don't know. Might be.
Columbus, Ohio. I think I went there from Cleveland. It's a few hours from Cleveland. I think we drove there. Long time ago.
Swing back around. Come back through.
The swing has gotten much bigger. It takes longer to get back around now, boy.
I'm sure.
It takes years.
Yeah.
But it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah, well, thanks again. I really appreciate it. So it was good to meet
you
and talk to you today.
Yeah, thank you. Anytime. All right. Take good care.
You too.